Good evening. I'm Betsy Cannon-Smith, class of 1984, and I'm pleased to welcome you to our virtual lecture series with our alumni guest speaker, Phil DiPicciotto, class of 1977. Phil's presentation, Perspectives Behind the Sports Headlines, will take us through his more than 30 years in the exciting and rapidly evolving work of sports and representation. Phil is president of Octagon Incorporated, and has been at the forefront of the sports and entertainment marketing industry for his entire career. Under his leadership, Octagon has become a global leader in the areas of talent representation, property ownership, event management, and sports and entertainment marketing. Throughout his career, Phil has built brands and managed the careers of many of the world's most recognizable and talented athletes and celebrities, ranging from Super Bowl champions to Olympic gold medalists to royalty and network broadcasters, including the likes of Bill Cowher, Brian Billick, Michael Phelps, Steffi Graf, Anna Kournikova, Emmett Smith, and the Duchess of York. Phil led the successful effort to remove tobacco sponsorship from tennis and has been recognized for his role in globalizing sports and entertainment. While at Amherst, he majored in anthropology and graduated magna cum laude. He went on to earn his JD from the University of Pennsylvania and then founded Advantage Sports in 1983, later rebranded to Octagon. We are in for a real treat with this insider's view that he will share. After Phil's remarks, we'll try to get to as many of your questions as possible. We welcome your feedback always and hope you'll join us for our next lecture, Global Health for All, on March 2nd with John Rohde of the class of 1963. Now I'll turn the microphone over to Phil DiPicciotto, who is joining us remotely from his office in Washington, D.C. Phil, welcome and thank you.
Hello, everyone, and good evening. Sports is a universal language. It's why it makes headlines. It's a window into our society. It's the ultimate reality show. It engages our passions, and it makes for great cocktail party conversation, as everyone seems to have an opinion. One only has to look at any media these days to see that sports is also big business. The competition for our attention gets more challenging and intense every day. Sports delivers by cutting through the clutter. It is exclusive content. Unlike movies or plays or songs, which always have the same ending, sports has an unpredictable outcome on each occasion. And it is best consumed live for that reason, which is ideal for advertisers who don't lose audiences on DVR programming. It especially captures the otherwise hard-to-reach male audience. And that's why television rights fees continue to rise for the biggest sports properties, such as the NFL, why NBC is elevating its programming with the NHL, and why the NBA made a return to work on Christmas Day. Entertainment of any kind, including sports, consists of two elements: something worth hearing or seeing, which is referred to as content, and a means to experience it, which is referred to as distribution. Without access to a distribution platform, content, including sport, would be quite worthless, like the proverbial tree falling in the forest with nobody around to see or hear it. The relationship between content and distribution has shaped the evolution of sports. With every change in technology, control of distribution has changed, and with it, leverage and value has changed. For most of the history of televised sports, distribution was king. The number of channels was limited, and events and athletes were literally made or broken by network decisions about who and what to expose to the world. Dick Ebersol of NBC has said that he made Jean-Claude Killy, and in commercial terms, that is largely true. More recently, cable TV, the internet, and digital media have flipped the old equation on its head. Whoever creates and controls content or programming, and that is now each of us, can easily find a platform on which to distribute it. Brands then attach themselves to this content as sponsors, trying to make an emotional connection to the consumers. So we have evolved from a distribution-based model to a content-based model to a branded content-based model. And therefore, sports and technology are made for each other. And technology has become increasingly integrated into sport itself over the years. Some of the ways are obvious. Electronic line calling in tennis, the yellow television first down line in football, instant replays in all sports, to name just a few. Technology can make outcomes more fair by confirming or not the accuracy of human judgment. This has become extremely important in sports such as track and field and swimming, where the margin of victory is often 1/100th of a second, as it was with Michael Phelps' gold medal performance in the 100-meter butterfly against Milorad Kavic at the Beijing Olympics. Omega's cameras shot 100 frames in the 1/100th of a second margin of victory. That's a rate of 10,000 frames per second. And it confirmed that Phelps had indeed won the race, despite what some naked eyes thought they had seen. Technology also has behind-the-scenes evaluative benefits. For example, every pitch in every Major League Baseball game is recorded, and the data is used to evaluate umpire performance. Home plate umpires turn out to be quite accurate with their ball and strike calls. In fact, their overall accuracy is 86%. But with three balls on a batter and less than two strikes, umpire accuracy drops to 80% in the favor of the pitcher. In other words, strikes are more often called on the close pitches that would otherwise be called balls. And with two strikes on a batter and less than three balls, umpire accuracy drops to just 61% in favor of the batter. Balls are more often called on the close pitches that would otherwise be called strikes. So interestingly, technology confirms that umpires have a bias toward letting baseball players control the outcomes of their at-bats and a bias against calling third strikes and walks. Technology is also changing how fans engage with sport. When Denver beat Pittsburgh in the NFL playoffs with Tim Tebow's dramatic overtime touchdown pass, Twitter erupted with 9,420 tweets per second, a record for a sporting event. The previous sport record was 7,000 tweets per second after Japan defeated the U.S. in the last Women's Soccer World Cup. A comparison to some significant non-sports events puts the usage of Twitter in sports into perspective. The royal wedding last year peaked at 4,000 tweets per second, Osama bin Laden's death at 5,000 tweets per second, and Steve Jobs' death at 6,000 tweets per second, all of which were topped by Beyoncé's announcement at the MTV Music Awards that she was pregnant with 8,800 tweets per second, but none were as high as Tebow's pass. The younger age groups are the predominant users of technology to indulge their passion for sports. In the UK, Germany, France, and Russia, the majority of fans are now using a computer, a tablet, or a mobile device to consume sports programming. They have moved away from a passive consumption experience to an active and engaged fan experience. Digital, social, and mobile media have increased the social importance of consuming sports live and providing fans with an immediate opportunity to engage fellow fans. So sports and technology have a strong symbiotic relationship, which is only going to grow stronger, has clear marketing implications for wireless service providers and device manufacturers, and also has potentially negative implications for teams and event promoters who are trying to draw fans into their arenas where they can generate not only a good atmosphere, which is helpful to the home team, but also revenues from tickets and concessions. For you soccer fans, technology is also likely to accelerate the development of the professional sport in this country. Those of you who played soccer yourselves or have children who play soccer have probably considered the reasons why professional soccer is not more popular in the United States. One big reason has been the lack of network TV coverage. That is changing. Fox has started to air English Premier League games against live broadcasts of NFL games, and those broadcasts have averaged over 1.5 million viewers. A second reason is participation. With every year that passes, we see a larger proportion of the population who have played soccer as kids. Those who played during the youth soccer boom decades of the 80s and 90s are now having children themselves, and a televised soccer match presents a healthy and relevant family viewing opportunity. Third, Americans have been slow to embrace a sport when we do not have the best global players playing here. The rise of digital, social, and mobile media makes geography less relevant, as fans can create a very engaging experience without actually going to the games. With the increase in our Hispanic population, soccer is closer than ever to a tipping point. Major League Soccer now averages more fans per game, about 18,000 in the 2011 season, than the NBA or the NHL. and this interest should be further fueled with the next Soccer World Cup coming to Brazil in 2014. Interestingly, globally, soccer now attracts almost 60% of every dollar spent on sports sponsorship. Sports have proven to be quite a safe investment for sponsors, even in times of economic stress. Sports sponsorship spending did not retreat as spending on advertising and promotions plummeted during the recent recession in the U.S. Overall sponsorship spending in North America was essentially flat, and even as technology enhanced the stay-at-home experience, 76 million adults attended a live sports event in 2009, up from 72 million a year earlier. Business and sponsors are now interested in measuring consumer behavior in relation to sports in a way that is as valid as other consumer metrics upon which other industries have come to rely. Recent research has yielded quantifiable information and insights into the emotional connections consumers have with sports to explain concretely why fans feel the way they do during good and bad times about a particular sport or team or event or athlete. These analyses now show that differences within a fan base go beyond simple demographic differences. Returning to soccer again as an example, fans in Brazil are not as similar to their European counterparts as one might expect. For example, excitement about individual players ranks much higher in Brazil than in Europe. And when one thinks about it, that makes sense. The best Brazilian players often play overseas on European clubs that don't have an historical resonance with Brazilian fans. So fan passions tend to revolve around individual players rather than around the teams. And that is how much of the marketing of the sport is then based. In contrast to Brazil as a player export market, England is an import market, and fans there have a more emotional connection to teams than to players. The same kind of fan passion analysis has been done with regard to the Olympic Games. For the Beijing Olympics, the Chinese felt pride in introducing their country to the world, along with a new openness to joining the world community. For the Winter Games in Vancouver, Canadians took pride in hosting an event that was so reflective of their active, healthy, sporty, outdoors lifestyles. And for the upcoming Summer Olympics in London, people in the UK feel pride in showing that they're still relevant, also showing off their history, including the hosting of prior Olympic Games, but most importantly, their continuing relevance in the world order. Fan passion may not be affected as deeply as in the past by the economy or geography, but it can still be affected by work stoppages. The early work stops in professional sports were strikes, with the players refusing to go to work. They have little to no leverage in negotiating fair work conditions and compensation. But recent stoppages have been lockouts initiated by the owners, who locked the players out of their workplaces. Work stoppages can lead to radical shifts in the sports landscape. Let's go back to 1994. The 1994 Major League Baseball strike enabled the NFL to take over as the number one U.S. sports property. For the first half of 1994, before the strike, baseball and football fans were on a par. However, from August 1994 until today, Major League Baseball has trailed the NFL by at least 10%. As a result of the 1994 strike, overall league attendance declined from an average of 32,000 in 1994 to 25,000 the following year, and it took a full decade for attendance to return to pre-strike levels. The situation was different, however, with the last NHL lockout in 2004 and 5. First, the NHL was replaced on ESPN by poker. However, 25 of 30 NHL teams saw increases in attendance following the lockout, and a league attendance record was set. Owners had claimed to have lost a collective $273 million in the 2002-2003 hockey season because 76% of all revenues were going to pay player salaries. And the subsequent implementation of a salary cap, as well as rule changes such as shootouts at the end of games, getting rid of the two-line pass, etc., helped the game. And total revenues, which were $1.8 billion before that work stoppage, are now around $3 billion. As the hockey example shows, regardless of which side initiates a shutdown, work stoppages generally create a better alignment of interest between players and owners who can then share increased benefits. the idea of growing the pie is better than fighting over an existing pie. Even in the acrimonious NFL and NBA stoppages last year, where the overall split of the financial pie was the precipitating basis for the lockouts, there were a number of system-related issues regarding which there was a great deal of cooperation and understanding on both sides. In the NFL, the final split of revenues recognizes the different types of revenue that the game produces. The players get 55% of league media, which is essentially all of the national TV contracts and the biggest portion of the revenue pie, but they get only 40% of the local revenue. The owners were willing to recognize that the game itself, that is the players and the teams, are largely what produces national television revenue. The players were willing to recognize that individual team efforts generate the predominant share of revenue in local markets, hence their willingness to take a smaller share of local revenue. A reasonable rookie compensation system was created in the new NFL agreement. Both sides agreed that the ridiculously high compensation packages for many of the first-round picks was not good for the game. The new system still allows for very substantial deals for the first-round picks, but relative to veteran players, those deals are no longer out of whack. The prior system was so expensive for the teams drafting high first-round picks that the system was no longer seen as a desirable way to give the worst teams the best chance to improve. Player evaluation and player health are not exact sciences, and the financial hit to a team when a player did not pan out was debilitating, especially in sports with a salary cap. And unless the player became a star, his contract continued to be unreasonably high relative to his value to the team, making it difficult for teams to maintain a fair salary structure for its other players. Quality players would point to their greater contributions, yet lower compensation. The high draft picks, on the other hand, often had the sense that they had made their big score financially without playing a down in the NFL, which was harmful to team chemistry. In addition, rookie contracts now cannot be modified until three seasons have passed. This gives the clubs the opportunity to see, and the player the requirement to demonstrate, performance over a three-year period. And, not coincidentally, the average career span in the NFL is just 3.5 years. Another aspect of the new collective bargaining agreement that has gotten little attention is the elimination of the ability of teams to put poison pills in contract offers in situations where the incumbent team has a right to match, as with restricted free agents. A team's right to match was instituted to help ensure that if a current team was willing to pay a player whatever value he was able to obtain from another team, the current team could keep the player by paying him that market value. Some teams tried to circumvent the intent of these protections by including geographical provisions in their offers that had nothing to do with money, but would result in a much higher cost to their current team if they matched. For example, failing to meet a certain geographical requirement, like playing on the East Coast, would trigger an additional financial burden on a West Coast team trying to sign that player. The current CBA has clearly spelled out the terms to be matched, and they all have to be equally matchable by all teams. The original intent of the provision has been restored. There was widespread expectation that the new CBA in football would include a change to 18 regular season games as early as the 2012 season. In a complete turnabout, and after initially contentious discussions, the owners recognized the significant player health issues that the two additional regular season games would create. The final CBA gives the players absolute and total discretion to keep the regular season at 16 games. The owners recognize that the players, like the owners, have a motive to generate additional revenue that they would share, but that health issues disproportionately affect the players. In another significant recognition by the owners of a legitimate player concern, off-season workouts have been drastically curtailed in the new CBA. While some coaches have screamed that they can't prepare a team properly with the new limitations on off-season workouts, it is generally believed that these workouts have spiraled out of control in the last 10 years. The organized team activities, or OTAs as they are called, have expanded to involve too much contact, even though the players are not wearing pads. This is another area of recognition by the owners that protecting the players' bodies and their health is important for the game. Obviously, there were no off-season team activities or workouts for any clubs before the current season, and things went just fine. In fact, the 49ers, with a new coaching staff, coming off of a losing 6-10 record and having no opportunity to get a new quarterback, made it to the NFC Championship game. Less is sometimes more. The new CBA includes a financial benefit for players who develop neurocognitive disorders, whether or not due to concussions in games or practices, which is a further recognition by the owners of the inherent physical risks of playing in the NFL. The players recognized the value to television networks of labor stability and agreed to a 10-year deal. And finally, the Players Association and the league created a fund to provide benefits to older retired players not covered under the prior CBA. This is appropriate, as the generations before created the financial foundation for the players today. As usual, publicly antagonistic and sometimes hostile rhetoric was part of the process. But behind the scenes, people like Patriots owner Bob Kraft and Colts offensive lineman Jeff Saturday maintained a constructive dialogue. Once it became clear that the lockout was legal, the sides were able to focus on making a business deal. While the owners were able to achieve a modest change in the overall revenue split, most of the system modifications were good for both the players and the owners, and therefore good for the game. The underlying dynamics of the 2011 work stoppages in football and basketball were similar to those in past work stoppages. Rookies were eager to play. Older veterans wanted to maximize the remaining years of their playing careers, which meant not missing any significant playing time and having the chance to win a ring. But the players are always a wide range of individuals comprised of highly compensated and minimum salaried rookies and veterans, those on good teams and bad teams, those with existing contracts, and those with a free agency opportunity or chance to move to a better situation. Similarly, there is a broad disparity among the owners, not only those owning teams making and losing money, or big market and small market, or those with the ability to contend for a title versus those who can't in the short term, but for the first time, a group of young owners who have spent a lot of money to buy their clubs and who are no longer willing, behind closed doors, even if the public portrayal was consensus, to make their interests known. This was especially so in basketball, where some of the newer owners stood up to David Stern, for whom this would be the last major negotiation of his storied career. Add to that a group of powerful agents who had their own agendas, often posturing for the press or for their clients or for their own economic interests, who were at odds with Billy Hunter, the head of the Players Association. Those agents pushed hard for early decertification of the union in order to put more pressure on the league, as decertification would have enabled them to file an antitrust suit with the potential of triple damages. What was not extensively written about was the weakness of the decertification position, namely that antitrust cases often take a year or two to get to court, and the players were not about to sit out for 2 years. So each side has its own calculus of its leverage and how to maximize it, and the game of chicken was on. Unlike the NFL Players Association, which filed to decertify early in the process, the NBA Players Association did not. But much like the NFL, the NBA owners wanted to preserve their season. The short 16-game NFL schedule put a premium on preserving the entire regular season in football. But as basketball fans generally don't start to pay attention until football season has ended, the real opening day for the NBA in practical financial terms is Christmas Day. Not shockingly, both the NFL and the NBA made their labor deals at the respective deadlines to preserve their lucrative television and sponsor contracts and the loyalty of their fan bases. The system in the NBA did need adjustments, and the resolution has left both sides unhappy, which probably means the deal is within the range of fairness. A 50-50 revenue split was the likely outcome from the start. The players had received 57% under the prior deal, and that is where it ended up with some nuances. The owners had wanted a hard salary cap, with all teams spending between $60 and $65 million to preserve parity among teams. The flaw in that logic by the owners is that even if all teams were to pay the same total salaries, players would still want to go to New York, LA, or Miami rather than Milwaukee or Toronto for personal, professional, and commercial reasons. So the alternative, which is now part of the deal, is that the players can move to other clubs and there is no hard salary cap, but this is counterbalanced by two factors. First, the players take a bigger hit than before should they choose to move between clubs. A new deal with his existing club can be as long as 5 years with 7.5% annual salary increases versus only 4 years and only 3% annual increases with a new club. With multi-million dollar salaries, this compounding makes an enormous financial difference. And second, even more important maybe than the first reason, is that clubs exceeding the salary cap now have to pay a much more punitive luxury tax. That tax was $1 for every dollar over the cap in the prior structure, and it now goes up in stages to $3.25 per dollar over the cap, depending on the amount of the excess. So a player with a $10 million salary could now cost a team facing the maximum luxury tax $32.5 million per year. This is why the Lakers traded Lamar Odom to Dallas for essentially nothing. Moreover, a team that exceeds the salary cap a second year, called a repeat offender, is taxed another dollar at each of those levels. So a $10 million player could cost a team $42.5 million. In fairness to teams with an already high player payroll from past seasons, an amnesty clause was included to allow each team to release one overpaid player and exclude that salary from luxury tax considerations. Of course, the team still has to pay the released player his money per his contract. Now let's turn from pro sports to amateur sports. The NCAA was established in 1906 to protect athletes from the exploitive practices of the time, especially concerning safety issues in football. Intercollegiate athletics has changed dramatically since the NCAA's inception more than a century ago, but the NCAA has not kept pace with the changes in the sports world, and its rules governing amateurism are outdated. What was once a noble purpose, fostering participation in sports as an avocation, balancing academic, social, and athletic experiences, built on the principles of amateurism, has succumbed to the temptations and pressures of a billion-dollar business enterprise. How far the NCAA has strayed from its mission, now more often restricting athletes than protecting them. Critics of the NCAA have long contended that the NCAA and Division I schools are more concerned with exploiting athletes financially than with giving them an education. By contrast, the modern Olympic Games, a decade older than the NCAA, initially also allowed only amateurs, which in itself is ironic as the ancient Olympics featured professionals. But recognizing the new realities within the multi-billion dollar world of sports, the Olympic movement adapted in 1986 and made the necessary changes to recognize that many athletes were no longer amateurs. The NCAA has amassed hundreds of millions of dollars in net assets from television revenues that it did not distribute to its members, and this number is growing annually, not exactly what Congress had in mind when it granted the NCAA tax-exempt status. At the same time, an Ithaca College study in October of 2010 found that the average student athlete must invest $3,000 of his or her own money per year to make up the difference between an athletic scholarship and the actual education costs. As athletes are not allowed to sign with the NFL until more than 3 years after they finish high school, and basketball has a one-year delay, most athletes with NFL or NBA aspirations have college sports and the NCAA as their only real option. The NCAA has a monopoly. On what should solutions focus? Well, many rules are arcane and they do not make sense in today's lucrative TV environment. The NCAA punishes the wrong people. They punish student athletes by imposing sanctions, often on those who did not attend the school when violations were committed and were not involved themselves in the violations. Second, the NCAA enforcement process is ineffective, arbitrary, biased, and unfair. Most of the rule breakers never get caught and their schools go unpunished. Third, athletes do not receive the full cost of their college educations, a fair share of revenue generated, or independent assistance in planning for their NFL or NBA sports careers. Finally, pay-for-play violations should be seen as much worse than pay-to-leave violations, but this is not the case according to the NCAA. In pay-for-play, colleges and/or boosters pay athletes to sign to come to the school and to continue playing there. In pay to leave, unscrupulous sports agents or others pay athletes to sign with them and or leave early for the NFL and NBA. Pay-for-play recruiting violations are worse because one college gains an unfair advantage over another and should be punished accordingly. Instead, the NCAA focuses disproportionately on those athletes who are paid to leave and on their schools, even though the schools are actually harmed in the process. The only practical way to fix this is to return the NCAA to its role of helping athletes with rules and assistance consistent with its original purpose and charter. The reality is that the NCAA finds very few violations. Most are uncovered by the media or by colleges themselves. An unbiased, independent enforcement organization should be formed with standards, consistency, and due process. Punishments should focus on the actual people or organizations that commit violations. For example, colleges should receive huge fines instead of punishing current student athletes who had nothing to do with violations by eliminating their bowl game opportunities or reducing scholarships, as the NCAA does now. Coaches and athletes should be required to sign agreements that they will cooperate with investigations and abide by decisions even after they have left college. Penalties for coaches and athletes no longer involved in college sports could then include significant fines after the fact, whereas now there is no effective punishment, as illustrated by the Reggie Bush, Pete Carroll matter. Division 1A scholarship athletes in all sports should receive the full cost of their education expenses. The NCAA can afford to give them an additional $3,000 per year stipend using its current $400+ million net asset financial base. Then, we should allow relationships with sports agents, including the ability to lend athletes money to be paid back after the athlete leaves college, guide the athlete toward his or her professional career, and arrange merchandising deals. At the moment, an athlete can hire an attorney, but cannot hire an attorney who is a sports agent. That is like sending an athlete to an ear, nose, throat specialist for a chiropractic matter. In return for these relationships with athletes, sports agents should have to sign agreements with the NCAA that they will abide by the rules and cooperate with enforcement investigations. There is now an underground economy that favors the unscrupulous agents, and this would give the legitimate agents a level playing field. Athletes should be allowed to receive money from merchandising, including signing their own athletic apparel and equipment. Critics say solving the problems and consigning the amateurism myth to history will take continued pressure from fans and the media and potentially from Congress. Societal attitudes toward fairness are also at play in the performance enhancement controversy. Doping is the commonly used term referring to the use of performance-enhancing drugs in sport. Doping bans exist to protect the health of the athlete and to ensure fair competition, and nobody can argue with those goals. The use of drugs to enhance performance is considered unethical by most international sport organizations, especially by the International Olympic Committee, although ethicists have argued that it is little different from the use of new materials in the construction of suits and sporting equipment, which similarly aid performance and can give competitors an unfair advantage over others. Looking back at a few significant milestones in sports doping history provides some interesting context to today's issues. The use of drugs to enhance performance in sports has occurred since the time of the original Olympic Games around 776 BC. The origin of the word doping is attributed to the Dutch word dope, which is a viscous opium juice, the drug of choice of the ancient Greeks. The ancient Olympic champions experimented with herbal medications of many kinds in an effort to enhance their performances. By 100 AD, gladiator competitions and chariot races were popular in Roman culture. The Colosseum was expanded to hold 60,000 spectators. Chariot racers fed their horses substances such as hydromel, an alcoholic beverage made from honey, to make them run faster. And gladiators ingested hallucinogens and stimulants such as strychnine to stave off fatigue and injury and to improve the intensity of their fights. In the late 19th century, the modern applications of drug use in sports began with preparations made from the coca leaf, the source of cocaine and related alkaloids. A widely used mixture of coca leaf extract and wine was even called the wine for athletes. Coca and cocaine were popular because they staved off the sense of fatigue and hunger brought on by prolonged exertion. The first effective performance-enhancing drugs, the amphetamines, which were widely used by soldiers in the Second World War, crossed over into sports in the early 1950s. In 1968, the International Olympic Committee instituted its first compulsory doping controls at the Olympics. At that time, the list of banned substances were largely narcotics and stimulants, including alcohol. Although it was suspected that anabolic steroids were being used at this time, testing methods were insufficiently developed to warrant their inclusion in the list of banned substances. Since then, steroids and masking agents for steroids have been front and center in many doping controversies, and there is little to no support for cheaters, nor should there be, as fairness and health are compromised. However, there are some bizarre stories. In 2006, Olympic skeleton racer Zach Lund, ranked number one in the world, was banned when he tested positive for finasteride, a substance in his hair growth medication, Propecia. Finasteride was not on the list of banned substances until 2005 and was removed again from the list at the end of 2008. But for a while, it was thought to be a masking agent for steroids. This case is sometimes called the folly of the follicles and is one of the most bizarre and unfortunate cases involving any athlete. Another was the ban of Martina Hingis, the tennis champion, allegedly for a metabolite of cocaine found in her system in an amount so small it was invisible to the naked eye. Insiders know that Hingis was innocent of any doping or drug use. However, this was a strict liability case, and Hingis had to prove how the substance had gotten into her system, which ironically she would have had a better chance to do if the amount had been greater. New technologies can blur the definition of cheater and complicate whether a specific usage constitutes joint pain relief, a clearer field of vision, or a way to game the anti-doping rules. Consider an athlete who has LASIK surgery on his eyes and Tommy John surgery on his injured elbow. Of course, had he chosen amphetamines to improve his focus or steroids to increase his strength, he would have been banned and berated. Corrective eye surgery to raise one's vision level to 20/20 seems fair. But what about athletes who go into the procedure hoping to come out with enhanced 20/15 or 20/10 eyesight? Replacing a damaged elbow ligament with a tendon doesn't seem like cheating, as it is now done all the time. But what if it's done on a healthy elbow by a pitcher hoping for a few more miles per hour on a fastball that has faded over the years? Science is making it easier to cheat, easier to catch cheaters, and more difficult to draw the line between natural performance and enhanced performance. What is enhanced is defined by the rules of our society at any point in time. Using a diuretic is banned. Being anorexic is not. Certainly, abuse of prescription drugs, such as Ritalin and Adderall, is illegal because of the potential harmful side effects. Still, reports on the rising use of these drugs by college students and professionals show the demand for options beyond nutrition, exercise, and sleep. These drugs are just the first generation of possible brain-boosting supplements. There is mounting evidence that cognitive-enhancing drugs are on the rise. Since Major League Baseball banned amphetamines in 2006, there has been a dramatic rise in the number of therapeutic use exemptions issued to players for attention deficit disorder diagnoses, for which drugs like Ritalin and Adderall can be legitimately prescribed. In 2006, 28 players applied for the exception. A year later, there were 103, arousing some well-placed suspicion that many of these ADD diagnoses are just excuses to get the pills. What if there were a similar, legal, cognitive-enhancing sports supplement that increased alertness, concentration, reaction time, and focus, while also decreasing the perception of muscle fatigue? Well, in fact, there is. This supplement is sold in millions of outlets and is socially accepted worldwide. The supplement is caffeine, and it comes in three sizes, tall, grande, or venti, in the form of coffee. The pharmacological process from caffeine is very similar to that of the ADD drugs. If caffeine is such a clear-cut performance-enhancing supplement, why did the World Anti-Doping Agency first add caffeine to its banned substance list, only to remove it in 2004? At the time that it was placed on the banned list, the threshold for a positive caffeine test was set to a post-exercise urinary caffeine concentration of about 3 to 4 cups of strong coffee. However, more recent research has shown that caffeine has effects at levels as low as the equivalent of 1 to 2 cups of coffee. So it was hard for WADA to know where to draw the line between athletes just having a few morning cups of coffee or tea and those who are intentionally consuming caffeine to enhance their performance level. So should an athlete who has a double espresso before competing, after having had LASIK and Tommy John surgery in the offseason, be considered to have an unfair advantage? Or what about a man with 2 artificial legs? Consider the case of South African sprinter Oscar Pistorius, known as the Blade Runner and the fastest man on no legs. Pistorius, who has a double amputation, runs with the aid of carbon fiber artificial limbs. In 2007, he took part in his first international competition for able-bodied athletes. However, his artificial lower legs, while enabling him to compete, have generated claims that he had an unfair advantage over the able-bodied runners. That same year, the IAAF, which oversees track and field, amended its competition rules to ban the use of such technical devices, taking the view that Pistorius enjoyed considerable advantage over athletes without prosthetic limbs, and ruling him ineligible for competitions conducted under its rules, including the 2008 Summer Olympics. The decision was reversed by the Court of Arbitration for Sport, which ruled that there was no evidence that Pistorius had any net advantage over able-bodied athletes. Although eligible to compete in the 2008 Summer Olympic Games in Beijing, Pistorius did not qualify for the South African team. Maybe the court was right in that instance, but science will continue to offer new and improved methods for raising an athlete's game above the competition. Players, league officials, and fans will have to decide where to draw the line. Thank you very much, and I would be happy to try to answer any questions.
Phil, thank you so much, and we do have quite a number of questions. I'll start first with taking you a little bit on a separate track, which is Octagon also works with celebrities outside of the sports world. So we have a question, just wondering what that kind of work is relative to, compared to working with the sports folks that you manage.
Well, we try to build brands, whether it's advising corporations or institutions in sports or athletes or celebrities. With regard to an athlete and the development of a career, the first stages are the physical development and the sports training development, which then leads into commercializing the value of the career through the negotiation of contracts and marketing, and then the preservation of the income through wealth management. Our theory is that it's not what one earns, but what one keeps. We do that on a worldwide basis across all platforms of sport.
And you just touched on that second question that came up, which is about the aging of athletes. And the aging of athletes and celebrities must be one of the biggest challenges for someone who is an agent and serving that person. And you touched on it with the wealth management. But how does one manage the careers when the sport is really no longer a part of that?
When the sport is no longer part of, when an athlete has retired?
Yes.
Well, the athletes these days have a detriment in terms of career longevity. Careers are getting shorter and shorter. Generations of athletes who used to play for a decade or longer are now very often playing for just 3 to 5 years. So athletes are retiring very young, and they retire with the knowledge that they are generally unlikely to be able to do anything as well by the time they're 30 years old, as they did in their 20s. Very difficult environment. But on the other hand, the amount of money in sports has grown to be substantially large. And this has created a second industry for athletes who are typically helping other athletes. The price between winning and losing has become so great that every athlete is willing to accept services from others who have been there before to try to give them just the little bits of advantage that will help make them into better athletes or have longer careers. So there are broadcasters, there are physical trainers, there are coaches, there are many professions for athletes to go into. And many of them have been able to sustain a very visible and quite lucrative sports career in terms of a second career after they get off the playing field.
And similar to that question, this is a little bit of a different take on it. Someone's asking about the generally short playing careers of professional athletes, which you've just mentioned, and the continual risk of injury. So how front of mind is that, and what can they do to offset the risk? Is an insurance, for example, an effective tool for athletes?
So the various sports who want their athletes to play for as long as possible, because brand value is generally increased over time, are the ones who are forcing athletes into shorter and shorter careers. The demands on athletes are getting greater and greater, whether it's increased number of games, increased number of practices, or just the level of physical strength and stamina required to participate at a very high level. I'm sorry, Betsy, could you ask me the question one more time?
Well, the second part was, is insurance an option or an effective tool for most athletes?
Yes. So the premiums for insurance have continued to rise because of the extreme physical nature of these sports. There are times within a career where it makes absolute sense for an athlete to obtain insurance. And they are generally before an athlete will have a big payday in the season before. Very often teams will go in and try to negotiate with an athlete a year or two or even three ahead of a free agency period or ahead of a natural negotiating time frame. It is usually the case that the team makes a lowball offer because they're giving the athlete security. They are eliminating some of the risks. They are taking more risks on as a team because you have to overpay for the performance in the short term where you would have a player under contract at a lower salary. And now players have the leverage to say no, in part because they can buy insurance to protect them during that period of time to get them to free agency period.
Great, thank you. And from right here on campus, we have a question from a student. What was your first job in the sports industry, and how were you able to come by it? And you can tell this is someone who wants to work in the industry. So what is the best way for a college graduate to enter this field?
Unless one is an athlete or a coach, sports is an application of another skill set. So for anyone who wants to become a writer or a doctor or a lawyer, or a financial professional, psychologist, whatever it may be, the best thing is to become expert at that and then apply it later to sports. My first job was just completely a fluke. I was an amateur photographer and ended up getting into the business that way and was given an unpaid summer internship after my first year of law school, which ended up being at a place that I never left.
So they should take those unpaid internships. Phil, another question. Bill Bowen's book, The Game of Life, shows that college athletic programs are losing proposition and an economic drain. So the question is, why do colleges continue to sink the resources into these programs and pay some of their coaches as some of their highest paid employees on campuses?
Well, they are a losing proposition at most schools, and the emphasis of sports at a high commercial level is really just at the Division 1A schools. So I think part of it is that a successful sports program brings enormous visibility to a university, and I believe that there are statistics that show very clearly the effects, as much as they can be quantified, both in terms of alumni giving and in terms of student applications to the schools. There are also a little bit less visible benefits to a lot of these schools. Most of them have affiliations with a sports equipment manufacturer, and they will get a split of revenues for all the goods and the gear that are sold. And whether a team is good or bad, whether there's a lot of television revenue coming into the school directly as a result of the performance of the team or not, you know, merchandise sales have become a very important revenue stream. There are naming rights opportunities at stadiums. There are just less direct ways to connect to some of the boosters of the school. Sports seems to be a very attractive proposition on many levels for these schools, even though it is true that given Title IX and given some of the interests in students to participate in sports that really don't make money, in the aggregate, it does turn out to be a losing proposition. I think it's part of the athletic experience. It has the intangible benefits of school spirit and other such things. So schools are just trying to keep up with each other, and they all have made the decision that at some level it's worth the cost, and in some few cases it's also worth an awful lot of revenue.
Thank you. A couple of questions on the Olympics. One is your own thoughts on the choice of London as a site for the Olympics. And a second question, are there any big surprises you're expecting this summer at the Olympics?
London was a surprise winner. You know, the stakes have gotten very, very big. Cities will bid against each other, spending enormous amounts of money in the process. And typically, the bid cities are whittled down over time until there's a final selection made among three cities. There are delegates from all of the countries that are part of the Olympic movements who end up trading votes with each other on some obvious and some very unobvious bases. So there may be smaller countries who want a world championship in a relatively non-visible sport who will trade a vote to give the Olympics to one of the candidates if they can get something back for their countries. And there are allegations that the process is sometimes a little bit more corrupt even than that. So it's never a certainty that a certain city will prevail. There is an attempt to rotate the Olympics on an irregular schedule among all of the continents. I think that there is now an understanding that the Olympics can do a lot of social good and societal good, and both the World Cup and the Olympics have focused on Africa and on South America as places that are good locations for their upcoming games.
And have there been any decisions?
Surprises in terms of the athletes. I think it's too early to tell. You know, there are so many things that can prevent an athlete from performing. Imagine training for 4 years and for many years before that to have the performance of a lifetime on any given day at any given moment, given all the vagaries. So it's very hard to tell. We're, of course, hoping that Michael Phelps adds to his 14 gold medals. I think the world will be watching that. This will be his last Olympic Games. And there will probably be stars who emerge, but at this point, I really don't know who they might be.
And it was asked how many Olympic athletes you'll be representing.
We will probably be representing around 100 Olympic athletes in various sports, and we try to keep tally of how our athletes are doing during the games by considering Octagon as a country. We're hoping for a top five finish.
Great, and it looks like we've got one last question here. Phil, you've made a compelling point about the psychic and external benefits of sports in college. Do you have a similarly positive rationale for the other notable economic boondoggle, public stadium financing? Now, how's that a question to end on, Phil?
You know, the topics really overlap quite nicely because there's an expression. There are two forms of deception, lies and statistics. And there are all kinds of statistics that show that public funding for stadiums makes no sense, and there are other sets of statistics that show that they make great sense. So the positive that I can relate is that there is a very large cottage industry of businesses that grow up around stadia and arenas. Downtown areas have been completely revitalized by them. Areas that have been left to decay have been revived by them. And there are cases, many cases, where there ends up being substantial corporate funding on top of public funding that brings long-term benefits to having a team in the region. The short-term public expenditures, I think, are under substantial pressure. There are some locations where they seem to make more sense than others. In general, I think that there was a time when they were much more popular than they will be in the foreseeable future, because when times are good and everybody wants to add to the excitement of their city, they're willing to spend and take chances. And when money is tight, as it certainly is now in municipalities in particular, everything is scrutinized more.
Great. Well, thank you very much. And I see we're just a couple minutes past the hour, having started a couple minutes late. We thank you all for hanging on with us through those first couple of minutes. And Phil, thank you for a really interesting and wonderful talk this evening. It was great to spend the hour with you.
Thanks very much for inviting me. It was nice speaking with all of you as well.
Good night, and we hope you join us for our next call in March. Thank you.